CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. I welcome Professor Richard Epstein, a senior fellow for the Hoover Institution. He teaches law at NYU and the University of Chicago. And in an essay published at Defining Ideas, a tribute to the passing of Daniel Kahneman, a Nobel Prize winner in economic sciences in the 21st century, and other tributes and awards from all manner of distinguished institutions. I read, however, that it comes to me to understand some of the work Professor Kahneman left behind him. And the one that I most like is called the endowment effect, the endowment effect. Richard, a very good evening to you. If I understand it, if I have a coffee cup that I've purchased for $5, that it is within my psychology, my temperament, when I go to sell it, I will have a different price because I have possessed it. Do I understand the endowment effect?
Well, half of it. You don't have to purchase it. You just have to have it. And one of the reasons why it's such a stunning finding for most people, that the willingness to accept, right? The WTA, as opposed to the willingness to pay, turn out to be different, is you can't figure out any reason why it is that that should be so. If somebody were to tell you in the simplest terms that the reason I have a lot of affection for this ring is it's the one I got married with, everybody understands a subjective attachment. And indeed, most of the work on market economies have the following proposition: where there's subjective value of goods, it means that the owner values them more than the rest of the world. And so the owner is not going to put them up for sale, may occasionally sell it if somebody gives a ridiculous offer coming out of the blue, but usually subjective preferences are stable. And what they're trying to do is to say it's not subjective preferences that really matter. It's the mere fact of having something that gives you that particular kind of feeling as against somebody else. And what it is it's unmotivated. And so what they do is they say, well, this kind of shows you that there's a stickiness in markets, because if there were a neutral price somewhere between, you would expect that to go to the other guy. So the standard rational choice theory says there are no such endowment effects. If I have something and you value it more because it fits in with your collection better than with mine, you will buy it from me if the transactions cost are lower than the net gain. So to give you a kind of a simple-minded example, you and I both collect baseball cards. You're missing a Joe DiMaggio. I'm missing a Mickey Mantle to complete our sets. And each of us have two of the other cards. An exchange between the two of them means that both people have completed sets of these baseball players, and each of them thinks that the card they receive is worth more than the card that they gave, not because of its intrinsic value, but because of the way in which it fits into some kind of a collection. And what they always are doing is they're trying to create mysteries, and when the mysteries get created and you can't solve them, this becomes an argument to say there's something about a market economy which is not robust. And so then the question is, can you take this thing out of this sort of laboratory setting and figure out how it works when you're dealing with real markets? And it turns out the reason you don't know anything about the endowment effect is in real markets, it plays really no particular role. Now, what do I mean by a real market? A real market doesn't have isolated players. It has complicated institutions and firms. And you're in a firm which is now trying to sell any product, call it a widget. And you have salesmen. And what you do is you give them incentives to sell this thing, so that the more that they sell, the more they get by way of commissions, or the more they get by way of promotion, or the more they get by way of bonus. So you ask yourself, is there an endowment effect which has no particular purpose? And now you're selling good after good after good through these kinds of incentive programs, which is going to be more important, the incentives or the endowment effect? And the answer has to be that the incentives are what really are driving the situation. So you institutionalize these arrangements, and all of a sudden, the rational choice theory, which they deprecate, becomes more powerful. But it's important to understand what rational choice is. It does not mean that people are always perfect when they make decisions. In fact, it means exactly the opposite. If you're alone in any particular kind of situation and relying upon your wits, you're going to make all sorts of mistakes with things that you're not familiar with. And some people will make more mistakes than others because some are smarter, some are dumber. Some are better at task A, vision stuff. Some are better at task B, language funks. And what happens, you got a lot of variation going on there. And what you have to do is to say, now the question is, Given that you know your frailties, what are the two choices? One of them is you could try to learn up on the subject in order to cure the frailty, and people always do some of that. But the other thing that you do is you hire somebody who knows what's going on in order to give you advice. And so if you're doing individuals with respect to mugs, it's not going to tell you very much about how financial markets work with trillions of dollars in assets, which are invested in mutual funds and which are guided by various kinds of financial advisors of one kind or another. And it's that kind of assistance that makes these markets most efficient. So at the same time you're talking about this funny endowment effect, there is another set of theories out there on the more rational choice side called the theory of efficient markets, and it has several things that it does.
This is Coase and Becker, the rational market.
Coase and Becker are very much the defenders of this version of rationality, where people with limited resources do the best with what they have in order to choose their own aim. The aim may be egotistical, as it certainly is in most cases, but you also can be rational in the choices that you make for the way in which you organize charitable activities, religious activities, and so forth. It'd be a terrible mistake to assume that there's no altruism in the world. The David Hume's famous remark about confined generosity, I think, is really very good. People learn to share, learn to care about somebody else and so forth. If they think there's a natural disaster, they're assuming that the people who are really hurt are not faking it, and they'll give huge amounts to charities. You get all sorts of church drives of people going down to one place or another, and they'll try to be rational. And what they try to do is to learn from their past mistakes, and what they try to do is to learn from advice that can be given by others who've been through these experiences before. So you make man a social being and put him into that particular context. The endowment effect plays absolutely no role in the ways in which these things go on. And so what I think is that all of the Kahneman and Tversky experiments that you start looking at suffer from what we call a common mode failure. Each of them take college students or high school students or anybody in isolation, ask them particular questions, and watch them fumble. But the real world is, so long as you know what you don't know, you're in a position to get advice or help from some other source. And if you look around the world, the helping professions are just enormous. And some people say, well, I don't know how to balance my family budget. And they don't. And so they get a life coach who tells them what they have to do. Or if you don't say, I don't know how to fly an airplane, what somebody will do is devise a checklist, which tells you the steps that you have to take and the order in which you have to take them. And if you follow that, you're out of trouble. And if you do that, what happens is a very powerful distribution of authority. So
let me use an example, Professor, to see if I understand this.
Sure.
I have a property, let's call it a portfolio, that I intend to sell. And the question is, do I have enough information to know when to sell and what to sell it for? Yeah. As a college student, I would have to make this decision on the basis of what I've learned so far. However, as a grown-up, I have opportunities to hire an advisor. I can hire many advisors, and some are identified with the bull camp, some with the bear camp, some with none of the above.
Yeah.
So the decision-making, if I understand Professor Kahneman's legacy, the decision-making is always comes to that. We have different tools to choose from. How do we choose the tools? What is it? Is it experience? Is it our recognition of our own frailty? What is the tool choice that I make?
My point was that was the fact of the world which they tended to overlook. They didn't worry about systems of advisors. And even the simple situation where you go into an automobile shop and have a friend come along, you're going to do better in bargaining than if you're going alone. Because there's always the guy now who says, I have to deceive two people, and that's going to be harder than deceiving one. What I'm trying to say is all these institutions take things like the endowment effect and push them very much onto the back burner. So that if you start to read any of these theories about how markets operate, they don't do it at all. They say, hey, you're out there, you have some information, and what you say is prices tend to equilibrate as everybody who has had shared public information will start to move this price up or down. And then what will happen is the trades will take place because one person's private portfolio has a better fit with this set of stocks than with that set of stocks. Well, one individual has a private estimate of value, which is high, will buy. Somebody has an estimate of future value low, and they will sell. And so what happens is you see these things, and then the markets start to converge. In the old days, there were huge gaps between willingness to pay on a market, the bid and the ask prices and so forth. Today, nobody trades intuitively. Everybody has these huge computers, and a tenth of a second is an eternity of time in which you could execute 1,000 trades. So what you do is you don't trade. What you do is you program machines to trade for you. And what you do is you develop these kinds of protocols. So what I'm saying is that the experiments tell you about a very small slice of reality. It's not even clear that they get it right. There have been many people, Charlie Plott and Kathleen Zeiler, who you do experiments and say, you know, these experiments are with activities that nobody's ever done before, and they just make mistakes in understanding what's going on. And so one way to deal with the endowment effect is to say, you give people the same problem 10 times and show them the mistakes on the first 9, they're going to do better on the 10th one because there's learning. So you ask them the right question, how do you do this? Well, the answer is if you're completely dumb and inert, you can't do anything. But most people work on multiple margins simultaneously. And so they don't know what's going on, they'll read a how-to book. They don't know what's going on, they'll ask a friend. They don't go on, they'll go back to their friendly banker and say, should I put this in a CD or should I keep it in a checking account?
And is that, what you just said, simple for me to understand, is that dealt with in the book that you say Kahneman is best known for, Thinking Fast and Slow?
No, it's not. It's a psychological book about individual quirks and behaviors. And what happens is these quirks do exist, but they get washed out with various kinds of institutional setting. And there's another difficulty with the book. It's not that it's wrong. Look, one of the things that you have whenever you do is you're always worried about what you're going to do with uncertainty. So let me give you a simple kind of example, which is followed all the time in practice. You go into the doctor's office and he says, you have a high creatine level. I do not know whether you have a kidney cancer or something like this. And so what they do is they don't send you off to the fanciest place in town. The first thing they do is they do a relatively cheap ultrasound. Now, why do you do that? Because it turns out 80% of the cases are going to be negative, and you just drop them out. And then you take the other 20%, and you start to give a higher resonance. So you now use them. You now use various kinds of CAT scans and things of that sort in order to figure out what's going on. And if it turns out you do, then there's another test that's more precise. But you're always trying to basically use simple tests to get rid of most of the cases and concentrate on the hard one, which means that you're using what Kahneman calls tier one and tier two intelligence. The first one is the rough and ready situation. The second one turns out to be not the rough and ready situation. It's more precise, and there could be a third tier. But this is just plain, shall we say, standard rational choice theory. What they miss in the book, or what he misses in the book, because he's a social psychologist, is he doesn't take into account the third system, which is the autonomic system. When was the last time you thought about breathing, John?
I do not. You're right.
Well, you do when you're going in the water. You do something you call hold your breath, right?
Yes.
Yeah. But on the other hand, most of the time you just do it. And if you had to say, well, I got to really make sure that I'm breathing, I might forget to do it. No, the body takes over. What about the fright impulse?
Yes.
It turns out it's exactly the same thing.
Yes.
You get frightened. It's not you're thinking about it. One of my favorite experiments is how little you could control the unconscious system by the conscious system. There was a movie called The Culpeper, something or other, Cattle Company, I think. And one of the scenes in there, what they did is they had a rattlesnake in a jar. And what they did is they showed you stimulated the rattlesnake and it tried to bite you and it just hit the jar and came back false. So then they said, what I want you to do is to put your hand on that jaw, now that you know the truth, and keep it there when it starts to strike. Nobody can do it. What happens is the autonomic system takes over, boom, and out you go.
Richard, we have less than a minute. Is the thinking fast and slow now been sidelined in the understanding of how we make choices?
As I said, it's essential for the many ways in which you do make many choices, but it's also conformable with rational choice theory. What it tends to ignore is this automatic system in the way in which it starts to operate. And what evolution does, something they don't really deal with, is it decides sufficient ways to make various kinds of systems when you really are acting alone. And the key on all of this stuff is certain things have to be done automatically and others not. And then there's interaction between these systems. And they tend not to worry about things that are instinctive because they're not the kinds of things about which you do social experiments. Kahneman and Tversky were both quite skeptical about evolutionary thought.
Professor Richard Epstein, in tribute to the passing of Professor Daniel Kahneman, I'm John Bashford.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.